Then we move to agenda paper number 4, which is insurance acquisition cash flows paid on initially written contracts. And I give the word to Maria.
Agenda paper 4 addresses a submission received about how to account for insurance acquisition cash flows for the following fact pattern only. The insurance acquisition cash flow is a commission unconditionally paid for its initial contract when issued. The initial contract states that the coverage period is unlimited, however, it is assumed that the contract boundary is 1 year only. Additionally, the entity expects a substantial number of renewals outside the boundary of the initial contract. The commission is also greater than the premium in the boundary of the initial contract. Therefore, if the commission were allocated to a group that comprises only the initial contracts, an onerous loss will be recognized immediately in profit or loss, because cash outflows, including insurance acquisition cash flows, are greater than cash inflows. However, if the commission were allocated partly to either other contracts that are renewed in the same period or future contracts on their renewal, it is likely that an onerous loss would not be recognized immediately. The submission provides 3 alternative views about the accounting treatment of the commission. Under view A, the commission, the specified commission, is considered only in the group to which the initially written contracts belong. The staff understand that the group would comprise of only contracts initially written in that annual period. Under view B, the specified commission is considered in the measurement of the group to which the initial contract belongs, as well as in the measurement of the future groups to which the contract, when renewed, will belong. Under view C, the specified commission is effectively allocated to initial contracts, as well as other contracts that are renewed within the same annual period. Both types of contracts are in the same group. Applying IFRS 17 requirements in this specified fact pattern given, the staff concluded that the specified commission paid on the issuance of the initial contract should be included in the measurement of the group of contracts to which the contract belongs, because it is paid for each contract and therefore is directly attributable to this initial contract. Additionally, the specified commission paid on the issuance of the initial contract cannot be included in the measurement of any future contracts to which the renewals of the contract would belong. That's because the commission is unconditionally paid for its initial contract when issued. Thirdly, the specified initial contracts cannot be in the group, in the same group, contracts that are renewed during the same annual period, applying the level of aggregation, the IFRS 17 level of aggregation requirements. In the example given, initial contracts are onerous contracts at initial recognition. That's because the cash outflows, including the insurance acquisition cash flows, are greater than the cash inflows included in the boundary of the initial contract. Conversely, the specified renewed contracts in the same annual period are not onerous at initial recognition, and therefore they would belong to a different group. We will now hand this over to you to get your views on the accounting analysis on this specified fact pattern. As I said before, a commission unconditionally paid for its initial contract and expected renewals outside the contract of the initial.
Thank you, Maria. Leslie?
I'll start. Actually, this submission raised some additional questions for us when it relates to, my apologies, which relates to acquisition expenses that are incurred or spent before the contract is issued, that are more generally attributable to the portfolio. That it was our understanding that we would be able to attribute some of those expenses to different groups that will enter the portfolio without any limit on the time period. In other words, some of the groups might be later, might be renewals. In other words, we thought we could attribute some of those insurance acquisition cash flows to groups that would enter the portfolio later, in other words, at the time of renewal. It doesn't all have to go with the initial issue. But then that brought up the question of paragraph 27, that paragraph 27 seems to suggest that you, or seems to say that you only set up an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows for groups that are issued. In other words, you can't set up the asset for acquisition expenses incurred before the group is issued. So we realized that we were confused about the whole situation.
Thanks, Leslie. But can we first stick to, okay, to this fact pattern and the question and conclude with the staff conclusion, yes or no, and then afterwards say, okay, what other questions that maybe then have raised? Kevin?
Yes.
Okay, say John.
Thank you, Martin. Of course, some of the comments made previously, it's important to note that this issue only applies when contracts are short-term bounded. For example, potentially for those step premium yearly renewable contracts. Within that context, we disagree with the conclusion on VUA. There is clear evidence available that policyholders stay with the insurer for many years. An insurer only pay those acquisition costs for this reason. The assessment of acquisition costs need to be done at the portfolio level, reflecting onerous contracts in year one and then profitable contracts for renewals in subsequent years is not a correct reflection of the economic substance of the contracts. The fact that acquisition costs are unconditional or have a clawback arrangement does not really matter for the economic substance of the group of contracts. We therefore support view B as the acquisition costs clearly relate to future contracts and should be allocated to those contracts here. We note that paragraph 15 state that IFRS 15 cannot be applied by analogy. However, one of the objectives of IFRS 17 is to align insurance accounting with general revenue recognition principles. So view A cannot achieve this objective. This seems in contradiction with one of the key objectives of the standard here. I note what Martin mentioned repeatedly that we are here to study the words of IFRS 17. So therefore, I propose a quick fix to remove the word issue of the standard, yeah. That will take care of this, yeah.
Okay, can we all agree?
Or shall we have no jurisdiction?
Kevin?
I also don't agree with the staff view of UA, because I think one of the things that this paper does is it introduces like a two-step approach to looking at acquisition costs. So it basically says you've got acquisition costs which relate to each individual contract, and those have to be linked to the contract, and then you've got those that are at a higher level and they can be allocated to the portfolio. Whereas I think if you read the standard B65, it says cash flows within the boundary of insurance contracts include an allocation of insurance acquisition cash flows attributable to the portfolio. So it's not saying you distinguish between, you know, individual and portfolio. So I think it needs to be assessed at least on a portfolio level. And I think tying into the point that was just made, just because the commissions are unconditionally linked doesn't mean you're not paying them in expectation of future renewals. So, you know, the fact that you're not going to take them away or claw back, you're still paying them for future renewals. So I think I'd be more comfortable with views C or B and I'm not sure why we're introducing this two-step approach.
Mary?
I was going to say, if I can elaborate on that point, I mean, I think very clearly we measure at a group of contracts level. This paper seemed to be starting to unpick that and to go to the level of the individual contract. And there are real practical difficulties in doing that. So typically, commission systems are set up to capture transfers between the agent and the insurer. So if you will, those acquisition cash flows go into a bucket, and we cannot then relate them to the level of the individual contract. And that's why this whole issue of grouping is so important. And so I would then say we need to look to paragraph 24 that says we can then allocate.
Mary? Next, Zanzelli.
Actually, we quite agree with the staff's view on this paper, because in this case, it says that it's a short-term one-year contract, and in our case, we discussed internally, there's not such lot of cases for life side. There's probably be some cases for non-life side. We have contracts that pay lots of commission first, but it's quite difficult to argue that if the contract is 1 year and you need to extend your commission and your loss to the year after, and in practical cases, sometimes it's not that practical to do that. So after our internal discussion, we quite agree with this.
Thank you. JP?
Thank you. As an accounting guy, my answer is very clear on this issue. I strongly support PA. If the contract boundary is ended in a year, as in the example, the contracts before and after renewal might belong to different groups. The unconditional acquisition cash flows are only related to the contracts which are first written and have to be directly attributable to groups. Even though the acquisition cash flows are unconditionally paid when a contract is first written, allocating these acquisition cash flows to different the future groups is not logical at all from accounting perspective. From the perspective of acquisition cash flow definition, however, some issues might be raised from practical forms. Even though the entity expects a substantial number of renewals over a number of years, allocating the insurance acquisition cash flows only to the first written contract logical in terms of the practical perspective. A situation where the acquisition cost is larger than the cash inflows of the first year is due to the strategic decision to secure a future profits, even if losses occur early period. I believe from accounting view, it is inevitable to recognize onerous loss at inception. However, to prevent this situation, I think we need to think differently, not only to solve this issue with the accounting, but rather, you know, insurers may consider changing business practices. For example, commissions to changes to agents, it is needed to be deferred or to be paid conditionally. I think I suggest thinking differently to solve these issues, not just focusing on the accounting principles. That's my view.
Mine, I have to say, because mine, I also struggle with the economic meaning of this kind of contracts. Because when, if I'm expecting that, okay, I'm paying that for many contracts which are renewed, then why I have this clause, okay, it's not refundable if it is not renewed? Because when we discussed this morning so often, okay, it should be made economically sense, and for me this contract does not make a lot of economic sense. And if somebody is expecting, okay, that you're paying something for which is then also renewed in the future, why I, if that is not done, why I don't agree, okay, if it is not done, that I get a refund. So, and For me, it was a little bit also a strange kind of case, and therefore it is important that we first answer this fact pattern, as you said, okay, in this, and maybe, but if that is different, it could be a totally different conclusion. Roman.
Yeah, maybe directly continuing at the point, Martin, from your side. I think it's kind of business practice that it's not refundable. And if you look at an on a group level, there's also no need to now refund on single contracts, because you need to have a look on the overall compensation for acquiring new business and then renew business. And so either you refund then the small percentage of not non-renewals, and but then the initial commission might be a bit higher on a portfolio level. That does not make really a difference. So the refundable, non-refundable, from a pure legal perspective, I understand that this is a difference. But if you go to a group level, it doesn't really make a difference. So the economic substance, I would say, if it's refundable, non-refundable on a group of contracts level, should be the same. So that, for that reason, I tend to view C. There are, I think, also good arguments for view B, because establishing a clear difference between IFRS 15 and IFRS 17 is a surprise, I think, to everyone who is following the IFRS 17 development, where I think always the reference to IFRS 15 was a very important one, and where we would like to have a kind of level playing field between the different industry and comparability, and here we're creating then explicit difference by having very the narrow, very narrow view, if view A would be the supported view on onerous contract determination. Maybe just to get an additional point into that, there are anyway difference with IFRS 15. I agree. For example, we need to take our capital costs into account when we have a look on onerous contracts, which is not relevant for other industries. So it's already stricter, I think. Probably it makes sense in the area of insurance contracts to have that measurement. But that on top of that, we are adding constraints with a very narrow view. It could be then view A, where some arguments also clearly are therefore for view A, but I think given the standard and the economic substance of such situations described in the fact pattern, I think view C is supportable.
Well, could I ask, would you also favour being more consistent with IFRS 15 in the narrow interpretation of the contract boundary, and also the narrower scope of the acquisition costs that IFRS 15 would allow to be treated in that way? Because I think you can't, they're completely different models. So we've got in IFRS 17 more cash flows that are included as acquisition costs that can be included, and a longer contract boundary is dealt through the contract boundary approach, and then a different way of treating, once you have a determined contract boundary, the acquisition costs belong with that contract. If you want to be consistent with IFRS 15, you can't just pick one or the other. You kind of have to deal with the whole thing under IFRS 15, and does that really get the outcome that you prefer?
I see your point, and there are two separate standards. The question is, was this difference created or not? So I am going through the staff papers at that point in time. I cannot remember, or the board discussions, I cannot remember a situation where specifically this was discussed. Okay, we want to handle that differently to IFRS 15. IFRS 15, I think, paragraph also entered relatively late in the process. I think there was a TRG discussion on that topic relatively late. IFRS 17 was in the late stage of development, so I'm questioning a little bit if the difference was created intentionally, and if there's really then this difference I need to read out of the standard. But different views are of course possible here.
And I understand your concern more again than if you cannot include that in contracts which are renewed in the same year, and you have to conclude then of an onerous contract. That is, I think, the wrong conclusion that you are most concerned with.
Yes.
Darren?
So picking up perhaps on a couple of points, I think to Kevin's point about the definition of portfolio, why we use the word portfolio, I've always thought of that, and I think the standard reads that is primarily about establishing the pot of expenses that we're talking about. It's not about allocating them. It's about establishing what the costs are that I can include, and I think to the point Andrew just made, that's potentially a more generous interpretation than what IFRS 15 has. Think about the portfolio rather than the individual contract. So I think that's the first one. Then you have the question of how you then allocate that to individual contracts or to groups. And I think, Mary, I think you can read the paper as saying individual contracts. I think that wasn't the intent. The intent is to apply the group process and to say, well, is there information that tells me that one set of contracts is different to another set of contracts? And in this circumstance, it feels like I've got information that tells me that newly initiated contracts do have a different profile to contracts that have been renewed at a later point. So that seems to suggest that I need to think about these as two different pots. And then I think I apply paragraph 24, which tells me to allocate the cash flows on a reasonable basis, or I think that's the terminology. And that would tell me that if I know that there's a group of cash flows, in this case commissions, that are attributable to this set of contracts I've identified, then I find it hard to say that you should just ignore that information. And I don't think the definition of what an acquisition cash flow is tells me that I must ignore the allocation process.
In the narrow fact pattern presented, I think I do agree with the staff. I don't like the answer, but I do agree with it. I would just caution, though, that I guess, Martin, coming back to your point, the commercial side, you need to look very carefully to make sure there are no other rights encompassed in the paying of the commission. So I think, but in this fact pattern, there aren't. So, and then I think I'm in view A. We did, though, have a lot of debate, and it comes back to the IFRS 15 point, trying to understand the rationale as to why we do end up with that, and it is the onerous contract point, when in both 38 and 15, I get the point there's a contract boundary, but I think if you had a similar scenario, you would take into account the expectation of renewals, and that's the bit we are struggling with to rationalise. I agree the words say that, but the logic, I think, is the bit we're struggling with.
That's a different question, right? So it's interesting what 15 says, and it's interesting to know, you know, why the board did or didn't do the same thing.
But the words I read this
words,
way.
Yeah. We landed on agreeing with view A, the staff view, based on the way it's written, noting the specifics of a one-year contract boundary and the unconditional payment. But there was a lot of debate, similar to what Gail just mentioned, around view B and whether that really showed the economic substance of the transaction. And also the inconsistency that we were seeing with the IFRS 15 and the inability to recognise that asset which would provide future economic benefit. There was a concern around the fact that this could drive some contracts, the new contracts, to be shown as onerous, and that really isn't reflecting the economic substance of that group of contracts or the group including the renewed contract. And the other thing we wanted to point out was the once you get into the space of having to split the new and renewal contract, you're going to add a significant operational overlay, which I know you're not there, you know, which is the actual, you know, practical, pragmatic application is going to be actually very difficult to do. So there were the three key things that I wanted to draw out. But the issue around IFRS 15 is an interesting one, because there is, even in the fact you gave, there is an acknowledgement that there's a benefit to that, the future contracts or the contract that will be in the future to that group. So, not comfortable, but agree that A is based on that fact pattern.
Leslie?
Thank you. To Daryl's point, we came to the point where we agree that it's a matter of allocation to the different groups in the portfolios. And in that specific fact pattern, it seems like the assessment has been made that that particular acquisition expense is to be allocated to that group, to the group of initial contracts. But recognizing that that doesn't apply to more general acquisition expenses, and in fact, if the fact pattern was slightly different, for example, if part of the commission was refundable or was only paid if the contract renewed, then it would be acceptable to allocate or attribute some of the insurance acquisition cash flows to groups that are to be initially recognized quite a long time in the future to renewal. Some people are puzzling some people's foreheads are going, but I just want to...
I think this will probably be the caution that Martin had earlier about being careful about answering questions too easily. But certainly I think if I change the fact set and say the fact set that I'm dealing with is that the commission is either only payable later on the event or something else happened, and that relates to that, that would make it more likely to relate to that event happening.
And equally, if there's a clawback, you include the clawback probability in the estimation.
I think you consider the clawback and say it's a different fact pattern.
I think the real difficulty.
So could have some of that commission could be attributable to the renewal if it was a different fact pattern.
You have to look at the facts and circumstances. This is a very narrow fact pattern that was presented.
Agreed. Okay, so that means that asset could be hanging around for a while until the renewal. Thank you.
Francesco.
Okay, thank you. I just would like to put a doubt I have on the paper, particularly when I read in IFRS 17, the definition of acquisition cost, the second part of the definition talks about acquisition costs include costs that are not directly attributable to contracts. And they are acquisition costs because of their nature. And so the typical example I have in my mind when I was reading that definition is I'm setting up a call center. The only job of the call center is to phone people and ask them, would you like to buy insurance policies and make the sale? So there will be a number of costs for that call center. There will be salaries, non-refundable. I will have both a telephony system, again, non-refundable. I will have other overheads, all entirely incurred to do that call center and to make it work, to sell policies and to assemble contracts. And to me, those were very clear examples of where the application of the definition would have told me when those contracts are incurred, one of the costs that I paid for to acquire them is the setting up and the running of the call center. When I do an analysis of those costs, then I find that there is a potential conflict with paragraph 27 that says you can only recognize an asset for acquisition cost if the contracts have been issued but not yet recognized. So all those costs that I'm incurring before the first contract has been issued and by the clever call center person that manages to speak to the willing customer who wants to enter into the contract cannot be recognized. Ultimately, that is a matter of timing. People say, well, how long is it going to take really for a good call center to sell the first contract? Maybe a couple of hours. But here we're looking at renewal that may take a longer period of time. If I may finish, Joanna, then you can speak. I think it's the rule. Then I'm really wondering whether there is more guidance that needs to be given to the definition of acquisition costs that are not directly attributable to the contract as to when those would be deferrable, because if they are acquisition costs and if they are deferrable, then against this commission, which is a component of acquisition cost non-attributable to a contract but incurred only to sell acquisition to sell contracts to be assembled in the portfolio, then I would say I can see the basis in the definition of 17 to recognize that in 27 and to take that as an asset. But clearly, as Sai Chung and Leslie pointed out, the word issued in 27 may seem to suggest that it's only for issued contracts not yet recognized that will be possible. In that case, what is going to happen to my call center, let alone the renewal commission? This is a new ground that I did not expect to be elevated in the context of implementation of acquisition cost definition, given what you have written in the staff paper for number 4.
27 does refer to a group of issued insurance contracts, but refers it in the same sense as trying to differentiate between insurance contracts that an entity issues as opposed to holds or purchase, you know. So issued doesn't mean actually issued, but it's an insurance contract that's issued, so you're the issuer.
So it's about to do with the origination.
Yes, okay. Yes, it's about the origin, and that's why we use the term that. If you go throughout the entire standard, you notice that issued is used a lot to indicate, because we flip between the reinsurance contract held and the insurance contract issued. So I could have made that Chaucer by pointing that out.
Thanks for that clarification. But I also think this call center example is different from what we have here, because we have here it is okay assigned to each individual written insurance contract, and with the call center, I think there is not direct linkage between
allocation question.
Different allocation question, and therefore I think it's a different example. Next is Massimo.
Yeah, just to come back on the meaning of issued, because let's say I'm wondering if let's say from looking at the economic substance of the transaction, I'm able to allocate part of this acquisition cost to group of contracts that will be renewed. If in this case paragraph 27 is applicable or not, in your view?
Issue here is meaning the sense that it's insurance contract that you issue, so not that it actually issued.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So if you look throughout the standard tries to make the differentiation between insurance contracts that are issued mm-hmm. versus reinsurance contracts.
So
that
associated
are out.
With my origination activities.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
So probably if in the process of allocating acquisition costs to different group of contracts, there are legal or, let's say, economic circumstances that enable me to allocate a portion of acquisition costs to the renewed contracts, probably paragraph 27 is applicable.
Very helpful.
Very helpful. And it allows you to.
That would be consistent with UB. Of the staff paper in that particular case.
It's a different fact pattern you've given. So I don't think we can then say.
Yeah. No, but in that case, the UB could be applicable if the fact patterns that I introduced is valid.
It could be applicable, yes. Yes.
Okay, maybe as an interim summary, because what I'm hearing is okay that many people agree to the staff conclusion. But I think if the fact pattern are different, there could be different yes. conclusion. And also I think even if it is case the first fact pattern, exactly that, that some people think, okay, that maybe the accounting conclusion is right, but the economic conclusion is not, I think, right, because especially if we then connected it to onerous contracts, because I think, okay, economically, this acquisition costs are clearly also for renewable contracts, and therefore it is not fair if I allocate everything then to one set of contracts and make these contracts onerous. And that is the wrong economic conclusion. Having said that, I think that is what I have heard so far. And if you don't agree or agree, say John.
I think the other thing that's come up that might be useful, even though it wasn't really, I don't think, to me at least, directly what the paper was about, is the point that the conversation between Francesco and Joe about what 27 is saying and not saying, because it's not trying to link the recognition with whether you've actually managed to issue a contract.
It's just
breaking that nexus.
Yeah.
So maybe we could say sort of in discussion it was noted or something, so it's not directly the question that was addressed. Mm-hmm. But
and I'm also not sure we all agree with view A. I think some of us thought view C.
In this fact pattern.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to add to what Gail mentioned about unconditional. Insurance acquisition cash flow, typically they do not only consist of commission, but also production bonus, persistency bonus, and other payments that take into account the performance of the portfolio. In cases where persistency is part of the requirements for determining the overall acquisition cash flow, I think it's important that the future renewal of those contracts need to be considered as part of the fact pattern here in determining this issue.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
I think it's somewhat reiterating what you said, but you know, for straightforward GI business where we're writing simple contracts, we're writing lots of them, you know, it's kind of back to a number of things that were said, but you know, we do look at them on a portfolio basis, we do price them on the basis that some of them will renew, but we don't need to go to the trouble, or it's just business practices developed, we don't need to go to the trouble of putting in clawback clauses and you know, trying to, you know, we're measuring on a portfolio basis, so it's sort of the economic a substance overall ends up being the same, that's how we think about it, that's how we price it. We don't put it, all this complexity in, and it feels like because we're not doing that, it's creating a difference in the measurement. So I suppose it comes back to what do we really think onerous means? We don't think it's onerous because it's clearly profitable business. And you know, we're just really simplifying the business practice.
But it is onerous, isn't it? If you calculate the way that 17 requires you to calculate, even if you're thinking about it differently economically.
It's onerous in the context that the contract that you have signed is not profitable. You need another contract. You need a renewal which is entirely voluntary in order to make it profitable.
I agree that's what the words. That's what the words of standard say.
I think that's also the economic reality. The economic reality is that it is.
The economic reality is that we're writing quite high volumes of this business year after year, and we know how much renews.
You are relying on that renewal
because we're looking at it on a portfolio basis.
Francesco.
I just wanted to check a point of consistency, logical consistency between what we discussed earlier on reinsurance and the discussion that has now been clarified on the issue contract. So earlier we were saying that you will have to take into account in the SB staff said that they read the paragraph 62 to say we are just deferring the initial recognition by a few weeks, but then at that point you need to take into account all the contracts that are either issued on that day or later as long as they fall within the boundary. Now, this is not an insurance contract. It's not an insurance contract. It's a distribution agreement with an agent. But it is entered also on the expectation that this payment will generate future contracts. So isn't there then a logical parallel here to consider those acquisition costs covered by the scope of the standard and the definition to actually cover future contracts to be issued in the same way as we said our insurance contracts held in proportional coverage would require us to consider, in the best estimate, contracts yet to be sold?
I think something that Daryl mentioned before makes a lot of sense, that we need to look differently on the definition. The definition is there to include more cost than usual. So we look at the portfolio. So if you remember, unsuccessful efforts can go in there. But then you need to do the allocation, and to do the allocation in the most reasonable way and using supportable information. And I think one of the points that I heard here is that if you have information about a specific way of allocation, you can't just ignore it, acknowledging that it might be difficult or there might be different ways to handle it. But ignoring this in the allocation might seem a bit unsensible.
I think the difficulty
is the distinction between what is insurance acquisition cash flows and then how you go about the allocation.
I wouldn't ignore it now, but in the same way as I take into account future business that are not yet sold for insurance
I think
into account future insurance contracts have not yet sold for a distribution agreement that are signed.
But I think the difference is that in the reinsurance contract, you're on the hook, so when those contracts are sold, you will have to reinsure them. Here, there is no obligation on either side of the other contract to be issued, and that's the economic difference. That
but often such distribution agreement include the persistency.
The difference is that
so when
it's an assumption. If there's no clawback, it doesn't matter. It's not relevant. It assumes an assumption.
Yeah. It's cash out the door.
Do we call it prudence?
Just ask for one point of clarification, which is if in applying premium allocation approach I apply paragraph 59A, so I'm actually expensing my acquisition costs, can I just be clear then that my new business and my renewals are absolutely on the same terms and that I could include them within the same group? So, dealing with business that's being accounted for, assume it qualifies to the premium allocation approach. And so, therefore, under 59A, I can choose to expense all of my acquisition cash flows as I incur them. Can I just clarify that that then means that my new business that I write in the year and my renewals of existing business are on exactly the same terms, and I could then include them within the same group?
So what you'd end up doing, I think, in that circumstance is you'd create two sets.
or thinking
about the new, and then you conclude that
the cash flows are identical, and that would, I think, allow you to.
I think, remember the caveat that's very difficult to discuss. You know, you have different fact patterns.
I agree.
But I think you have to look at what the 59 says, which says expenses when it incurs those costs. So I think you have the question of when you have incurred those costs, and I'll leave that with you.
I would think you still have to allocate the expenses to the different group, regardless of whether you expense them immediately or set up an asset. It's irrelevant to the question of how you allocate them or attribute them for the purpose of measuring the fulfillment cash flows.
You wouldn't be in premium allocation approach, you're not measuring the fulfillment cash flows, you're doing premium allocation. So they've gone to P&L already, is what I think we need to think about it.
I think it's a bit difficult, and I think I would focus on when.
No, I respect that.
When it's incurred.
But at least it is an interesting idea to him.
However, Martin, I feel that the debate has changed a little bit the nature of the issue from being an issue of recognition to one of allocation. What I think I learned today is that, given the clarification, is that we cannot allocate. If there is a commission calculated based on the fact pattern, it cannot be allocated to anything else other than the first year group. So it's a view from the start that says allocation in that instance cannot be done in any other way other than to be put in UA, 100% to the first year group.
Yeah, and I've got a bit of a problem with that thing because of the words and the standard above portfolio level.
But what we said when we talked about that is that those words clearly define what an acquisition cost is. Are you reading those words to tell you how to allocate them?
No, I'm saying it leaves it open for allocation. It doesn't tell you have to allocate to the individual contract if you know it.
And then paragraphs like 24 that are explicit that you need to do an allocation on a reasonable basis.
So these are not reasonable basis. Is you're paying this for the existing the renewing contracts and the existing ones. So we're paying the person today, but we think we're going to renew.
You would be in the space of, for lack of a better term, you're in the space of depth. I think you said earlier you were in the space of width, which I would think, which is view C. I think you're actually saying you would allocate to the future, not to the other contracts in the same group this year.
So when I hear this, it seems that if you can argue that it's not directly attributable, then you have a way out. But when it's directly attributable, the staff says it goes where it is attributable, and there is no allocation effective.
Sorry, because I have another understanding. So let's say if factors circumstances enable me to allocate part of the acquisition cost to a future group, renewed group, I would apply paragraph 27 on this one factor. In that case, part of the acquisition cost that they pay now will be represented as an asset, and then let's say they're recognized according to the renewals. This is my understanding.
I think that's correct, excepting that the facts and circumstances that were submitted are not those facts and circumstances.
Yes.
I think the fact pattern of this example is not, I guess, really specified in details. So I guess that it should be an analysis. Which are
pattern is very specific. It's unconditionally paid commission for each contract.
So this is the trigger for the killer.
But for a group, for each contract unconditionally.
The commission is for each single contract and only unconditionally paid when it's first written.
Just one clarification to your point. I think a directly attributable defines the total amount of acquisition expenses. Paragraph 24 requires the allocation of them. So this is definitely directly attributable to that portfolio. The question is there room to allocate a portion of those to the renewals because
the
of the economic
says no.
substance?
The
right?
Staff says
the staff says no, but that's a judgment about
a judgment.
The specific fact pattern in assessing the allocation of these acquisition expenses. We may have a different fact pattern.
I think that would be good if it is in agreement with the staff to be part of the outcome.
I think we will definitely reflect that there are definitely differences in fact pattern. But, you know, we can only comment on the specific absolutely. We fully accept that this is not meant to cover all acquisition cash flows in perpetuity.
Okay. Any further comments to that? If not the case, then I would propose we go now to lunch.